Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, can you hear that noise in the background, Kieran? That's the sound of the Super League rumbling on, although I am in South London, it could also be a police helicopter. It's Questions Day, Kieran, but obviously there are a few news stories to catch up on You Know What. Sky reporting yesterday that the other 14 Premier League clubs are demanding the resignation of the CEOs at all the greedy six, and reporting that the Premier League are to remove executives of those six clubs from all committees and subcommittees. Which is most likely to happen, do you think?
The decision as to who is a chief executive of a private company is down to the shareholders and down to the individuals concerned. So there's a limited amount of wiggle room, I think, the owners of the other 14 have. There was David Dean was on Football Focus yesterday, and he was saying, okay, it's been an absolute disaster. People are suitably contrite. Ultimately, I think everybody in football does want the same thing. And the other 14 clubs in the Premier League need the Big Six as much as the Big Six need some other clubs. So they don't necessarily want 14, of course, in the Premier League.
Yeah.
So there's a difference between, you know, I think vengeance, which I think some people want, and blood, and having to accept that it has been an absolute disaster from the perspective of governance of the game and the reputations of the people involved at the upper tier of these clubs. And their reputations will be tainted for as long as they remain in the game. So I think it's up for them to make that decision. We've already seen Ed Woodward leave, although spin doctors are working overtime. The rumours now going round was that he wasn't in favour of the franchise league, and he resigned because he was opposed to it. which is unusual,
like the Jose Mourinho rumours that went around on the Monday morning.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And we still remember the Super League. The Super League company still has three remaining clubs in it.
Yes.
And according to Perez, who is the president of Real Madrid, it will cost the clubs that have decided to withdraw at least €100 million each. And of course, you know, one of the beneficiaries of that will be Real Madrid, if that proves to be true. Although I didn't think anybody could go beyond the degrees of denial that we've seen from Donald Trump earlier this year in terms of accepting the election result. But Perez has gone, you know, full Black Knight from Monty Python in his comments. He's saying that there were only 40 people at Stamford Bridge on Tuesday night. And they were being paid to protest. And, you know, and he's got no evidence to back this up whatsoever. He says all of the clubs in the Premier League are profitable, so therefore they could afford to withdraw. That's not the case. You know, they are losing money. It's been a very weird few days.
Well, now you've mentioned Perez. I was going to come on to him later, but I'm adaptable, Kieran. I'm like a middle-aged, overweight gymnast. I can switch from parallel bar to parallel bar. I mean, as you say, his defiance is incredible. He basically what he said yesterday was this is still coming, and fans were stupid enough to fall for the lies in the media. I think he might need to change his PR advice. But this €100 million, the contracts for the clubs have been leaked, and he's probably the leaker, and revealed that each club will have to pay €100 million breakup fee. Who do they pay it to, though?
Well, they would have to pay it to the Super League company has been incorporated in Spain, so therefore, presumably, it's enforceable from that perspective. And then, if the Super League company was wound up, one can only assume that there would have to be a distribution before that takes place. Now, to whom that distribution goes is uncertain. You know, I'm sure that Perez who, let's face it, is a multi-billionaire in his own right. He has been a very successful businessman. He would like that money to go to the three remaining clubs, Real Madrid, Barcelona, and Juve. But we'll have to wait and see. If I was up against Manchester City's lawyers, having seen their somewhat Rottweiler-like efficiency in terms of defending the club in respect of the charges from UEFA, I'd be not overconfident of getting these other clubs to pay up. So it's an awful lot of uncertainty. And one of the weird things which happened when we started to come through on Friday is that, okay, we've thought that Super League was dead, and perhaps we'd have a little bit of calm, and up pops Project Big Picture again. Jez Moxey, who's one of the seniors, I think he's on one of the board of the EFL, and then Rick Parry comes up and says, let's not forget Project Big Picture. So, okay, let's not forget Project Big Picture, and let's remind us what it was. Project Big Picture was written by Manchester United and Liverpool, who are also the two clubs involved in Super League, two of the drivers. And Project Big Picture is not an alternative to Super League. Project Big Picture and Super League were operating in parallel. Super League was the intention on how to treat European football, and Big Picture was how to deal with the domestic game. Yeah. And remember, this involved a concentration of power. This does sort of a bit of a reminder. There are a few consistencies here, where six clubs would effectively be able to govern English football. And they will be the nine clubs who had been in the Premier League the longest. Yep. Why they chose nine, I don't know. And why only six of them had to vote in favour of a rule, I don't know. But I think we can guess who those six are. So Rick Parry said, Manchester United and Liverpool are two of our great clubs showing leadership and exercising responsibility. And the message from both Liverpool and Manchester United is that they do genuinely care about the pyramid. Well, this seems to be inconsistent with their proposals to take control of the game. I appreciate he's a Liverpool fan. I appreciate he's former chief executive of Liverpool himself. And if you go to the Liverpool 2009 accounts, somebody was given a £3 million payoff that year, and somebody was given the highest paid director that year was also paid £1.4 million. Now, I don't know who that is, Kevin.
I don't know either, Kim, but I could take an educated guess. It's going to rhyme with Mick Barry, isn't it?
That's right. And remember, the chief executive of the EFL resigned a couple of days after Project Big Picture was announced, and the EFL said, "Oh yeah, he's only been in the job 3 or 4 months, and he's now resigned because he," but nothing to do with Project Big Picture. So, who knows what's going on? I just don't understand the logic.
Nor do I. I don't think I've got enough room in my brain for Project Big Picture this week, Kieran, to be perfectly honest, with all the other stuff going on. But Rick Parry's doing a very good impression of a man who's saying to clubs, you just seem to have lost quite a few administrators and staff, because I would happily, if you need somebody to step in and take Ed Woodward's place, I'm available. Perez's logic as well, Kieran, I almost admire him. His logic seems to be that the other nine clubs will happily cough up 100 million euros each, split between those three clubs, who will then buy players to take on those other clubs in the Champions League for as long as it's possible. I think even Man City might have seen through that one, Kieran. But just briefly, because I really don't want to get sidetracked by Rick Parry, because I know our views on Rick Parry coincide, Kieran, and let's face it, the last pod we did was long enough. We haven't got time for a Rick special, basically. Nor indeed does producer Guy, rich though he is, have enough money for a protracted legal battle, which should almost inevitably occur. First thing before the second big story. That's how professional. That's because you made me get up really early this morning to do this.
I'm on the naughty step at home.
I'm not surprised, Carrie. You've got a naughty flight of stairs, I imagine. Really, it's one naughty step. But Kieran, I've said this to Baroness before. If you're married to one of the world's leading experts in something, occasionally the world will ask your husband to be the world's leading expert in something. You're only upstairs. The Baroness could have come and sat with you and... No, really, she listens to this occasionally. I was about to suggest she could come and sit and do some knitting with you or a jigsaw while you were being busy. That's a road that would get me into a lot of trouble, wouldn't it? This notion that the Premier League want to remove executives of those clubs from all Premier League committees and subcommittees, would that be because they can't trust them to be privy to confidential information now, or would that simply be a fairly half-hearted punishment?
Well, there has to be an element of trust if you are negotiating on behalf of a group of people. And the way that the people behind Super League have been operating in such a clandestine manner means that, you know, how can you face up people? And I think that's the big issue. Yeah, if I was Daniel Levy, knowing I was having to go into a meeting with 14 other clubs where they've been operating, you know, where he's been operating behind other people's back, and just nonchalantly say, "Hi guys, yeah, nice weather. How's the wife? You know, what was DC line and duty last night?" I just wouldn't be able to do it. So we'll have to wait and see. You know, and there have been some positives from this. The fan led review does appear to have now crystallised, and that's going to be led by Tracy Crouch. The government has said that, Oliver Dowden has said that if legislation is necessary, then, you know, then we will do whatever we have to do.
Yeah, we're going to come on to that in a moment, actually. But one final thing to come out of this over the weekend, Kieran, a big, big protest outside the Emirates on Friday night while the Arsenal-Everton game was going on. And while it was going on, Daniel Ek, founder of Instagram, publicly offered to buy the club. And also got loads of free publicity for Instagram in the process. But that was a strange 2 minutes of broadcasting while you're watching a rather sterile game, and up pops the news on Sky, accompanied by the Instagram message that this chap's basically said, if you're selling, I'm buying.
Yes. And the Cronkies have sort of pushed back to say, you know, nothing wrong here. We're perfectly happy. We are now dealing with the rarefied atmosphere of billionaires sort of chess battling against each other. So we'll have to wait to see. This is nothing to do with money at this particular stage. This is all to do with vanity and pride. Stan Kroenke, it would be a humiliating climb down to a certain extent if he ended up having to sell Arsenal. So he doesn't want to be seen to being have his hand forced. Not that he's ever said a dicky bird one way or the other about Arsenal.
Let's move on, Kieran, because before we get to questions, and we've got some really cracking questions this week as usual, there are a couple of other, I was going to say smaller news stories, but for the clubs involved they're not, are they? Bordeaux, one of France's biggest clubs, have gone into administration after their American benefactors appear to have pulled out.
Yes, this is COVID-19 related to an extent. Bordeaux have US owners called King Street. They only acquired the club in 2019. So, you know, a bit like comedy, buying a football club, timing is essential. And they've already put in €46 million, and they've just said, yeah, we've done the sums. It's costing us money every week. We can't see ourselves ever getting a return on this. So, you know, sorry guys, that's it. Clearly Bordeaux will have been hit in terms of loss of sale of match day tickets from the pandemic, as have every football club in every country where there is presently a lockdown or other restrictions. But the big issue, which we have discussed on more than one occasion before in respect of French football, is the TV deal with MediaPro, and it looks as if the French Football League has estimated that its revenue this season is going to be down by a half. Now, that compares to 10% in the Premier League. So all of the clubs are therefore reliant upon backers, and King Street have said, we've done it for 12 months. Sorry, guys, no more. So, you know, it does call into question the ability of clubs. And, you know, I think we both said that France is the country where we have the most concerns, because it is so dependent upon the TV money, which has now collapsed.
So you mentioned timing and the French TV deal there, Kieran. It's a sad reminder that the last time I was in Europe before this kicked off, as a few of us went on our annual jaunt to Europe, and we decided to go to Bordeaux, and we booked some tickets for the Bordeaux game on the Saturday morning. And on the Friday night, we were informed by a chap in the pub that French TV had moved the game to a Monday evening.
Oh, no.
I know. Being football fans, we thought we'd have a walk down the stadium anyway.
Absolutely.
Luckily, there's a half-decent bar not far away, so that saved the day. Ironically, football on TV from all over Europe. So from Bordeaux to Scunthorpe, which is a link I don't think I've yet made on this pod, Kieran, and we've made lots of links. Scunthorpe no longer owe money to the club owner. Presumably that's good news, but when Guy sent the questions, he put that in with a question mark. So I don't know whether that implies, Kieran, that it's can't be good news, but it must surely be good news, isn't it?
Well,
there's well, a well. That's a, yeah. You said that exactly the way Ali says well every now and again.
Yeah. The Scunthorpe owner is a gentleman called Peter Swan, and I will choose my words very carefully here, because I did write an article for one of the newspapers just over a year ago, which resulted in legal threats from Mr. Swan. Mm-hmm. Mr. Swan has owned the club for 7 or 8 years. It's made significant losses every single year. Over that period, you know, based on my figures, for every £100 of income, they paid out wages of 143%. Now, on that's not a good way to run a profitable business, clearly. But at the same time, Mr. Swan has underwritten those losses. He's lent money to the club every single year through his company, which is now owed £11 million. So he said, you know, enough's enough. And I've got to say, you know, I'll try to be even-handed on these things. Scunthorpe produce, I would give them a 5-star in terms of their accounts, in terms of the transparency and detail. So, yeah, there is lots of stuff for me to analyse here. And talking of 5 stars, Mr. Swan is also building Blackpool's first ever 5-star hotel. And as somebody that used to run a nightclub in Blackpool, I do wish him all the best. There's a lot of social deprivation problems in Blackpool, and anything which can bring a bit more glamour and attention to the town, I'm in favour of. So,
in terms, you know, I'll just stop you there for a moment, just for the benefit of listeners. In terms of stars, just put a number on the difference between how many stars this 5-star hotel will have and how many stars your Blackpool nightclub had.
I think they probably got 5 more stars. we did win the stickiest carpet in Blackpool award when I ran it. And all the local drugs dealers were, they love the place. when I used to do the administrations, which was a while ago, I did get an awful lot of experience, which I never anticipated when I qualified as a chartered accountant. But having to negotiate with drugs dealers as to what I would and would not accept was certainly not in any of the exams I ever sat.
I get it. You're a big fan of Line of Duty. I imagine Ted Hastings would think that's a clever idea. Sticky carpet means the drug dealers can't run away from the police. Stuck on Kieran's carpet, you're undercover. Anyway, let's not be distracted from your potential legal case against Peter Swan. Why is it not good news that they no longer owe money to Peter Swan?
Well, he had a number of choices. He said, you know, I think I've done enough, and he has underwritten these losses. So he could have just written off the debt straight. He could have converted the debt into shares, but instead he says, okay, I'll write off the debt, but I'm taking the club stadium in lieu.
Oh, bloody hell, right.
And at the same time, he's trying to build some properties, not on the stadium. He says that the club now has a 999-year protection in terms of nobody can move. If there's a new owner of the club, they cannot move them out. So he said that there is protection, and you know, you've got to take him at his word on this. He also says that there will be no rent paid. So that actually could be good, because the club was paying interest on the loans due to his company, Cool Silk. So you know, it could be a positive, but you know, we, in our experience, you know, and something which we've discussed again and again, when a club loses its stadium, things can turn ugly.
Yeah.
Not necessarily straight away, but it's one less significant asset that the club has. You know, certainly in our experiences at Brighton, when our stadium was sold at the Goldstone, you know, it took us, you know, it took us a long time to get back to Brighton. So, I'm just cautious about this. There's nothing explicitly bad or wrong about it, but yeah, why not just write off the debt, put full stop?
Yeah, let's deal with this last question as quickly as we can, Kieran, because it involves the Premier League and refereeing, which at the moment are not subjects that everyone's particularly interested in. But it's a point that needs raising. The Premier League accounts are out, and there's a lot of stuff in there, but in particular, you're interested in the refereeing costs.
Yeah, well, it's something which I think we've been asked before in terms of how much do referees get paid, and you know, we've looked at that. The Premier League made a payment to PGMOL, which I think is Professional Game Management or Officers or League, or I don't know, something like that.
The one that Mark Riley's in charge of, yeah.
Yeah, and the Premier League's had a tough year itself, because you know, it has been impacted by. Has been impacted by COVID, still gave £111 million in solidarity payments and to the grassroots, which was actually consistent with last year. But then the payment to PGMOL was up 30% to £13 million. So given that there are 380 Premier League matches, and I appreciate that they pay for other things, you know, the referees do have meetings with clubs and other bits and pieces and so on. It works out as £34,200 per match.
Right.
That does seem, you know, that's for the referee. Clearly, you know, two assistant referees, there'll be a fourth official, you know, the man that holds up the how many seconds are there to go. VAR. So the reason why it went up by 30% was presumably down to VAR costs as well. But it is quite significant when you do it on a match. I'm hoping that would be substantially less for the EFL, because that would take out a huge chunk from clubs in the lower league.
Well, they should save themselves a bit of money when Everton play, because Duncan Ferguson insists on holding up the board. This is not enough. Yeah. Having met Duncan Ferguson, I'm not going to stop him. But I know, Kieran, that we have a few people involved in the refereeing fraternity who listen to this pod. So I'd be really interested to hear from them what they think about this, because it's at a time when I was talking to a mate the other day who works on the pitch at Sellers Park, although he doesn't at the moment because he's one of about 150 people who aren't needed in the current circumstances. So I'd be interested to hear a referee's take on that. So let's move on to questions, Kieran. And as you'd imagine, we've had loads on the Super League. And again, as you can imagine, a load of them are now out of date. So I've chosen just one because several people asked this, including Joe Kurt and Paul Edwards, and it refers to something you've mentioned before. If the fan-led government review of football were to recommend a German-style 50-plus-1 ownership model, which you can only hope, would it be possible to achieve that from where we are now?
The only way that it could be achieved would be through statute. There would have to be a change in legislation. At present, clubs are privately owned. Why would Roman Abramovich give up 51% of Chelsea when he's put in £1.4 billion already? I think it would be quite difficult. And from a legislation point of view, and we've also got the fact that Spurs are controlled from the Bahamas. We've got Manchester United, which is registered in the Cayman Islands and traded in New York. So where does UK legislation stand with regards to overseas entities? So I think it would be a tricky one. There are alternatives to the 50+1, because 50+1, it's being spoken of as a panacea, and it was fantastic to see that the German clubs just said, we ain't going for it, and end of story. So I think actually that ship has sailed. We'd have to think of alternative ways of addressing the governance issues, and the fan-led review, I think we'll have to go down a slightly different route, perhaps to have non-executive directors on the board, perhaps to have some form of golden share where you don't actually own the club, but you have a veto power over certain aspects to do with football. Now, I think that, again, would have to be backed by legislation from the government, because I can't see the clubs necessarily voting for that themselves, and that's understandable. If you own a football club, why voluntarily go for it to relinquish power?
Yeah, it's Boris Johnson has clearly discovered football as a vote winner. It's hard to imagine even he deciding to arbitrarily say we're going to have a 50+1 model that might win me the next election. Although he needs a dead cat of some sort to throw on the table at the moment if Dominic Cummings keeps blogging. That door sound effect, by the way, Kieran, was that Finley the dog?
That was Finley, yeah. Okay. He was coming in with his wonky chomp here. The Baroness has given him his morning treat.
It's wonky chomp.
That's what they're called. They're called wonky chomps. Yes, hopefully I'm now going to get a box of wonky chomps on the back of this.
You're going to get something wonky if you carry on podcasting and broadcasting. Let's move on to the rest of it. We're 25 minutes in, 26 minutes in, Kieran, and we're not on to our listeners' questions yet. The first one comes from Liam Tyrrell. Now, Liam says, we know match day programmes have been declining in circulation for some time, and many clubs, of course, took them online during the pandemic. My team, West Ham, however, are still producing a limited number of printed programmes to purchase. Do you know how this has affected things for clubs in terms of advertising revenue?
Right, I think it would have a negative impact if you take a look at the print runs, and I'm indebted here to my mate Uncle Ian, who is the king of programmes. He says that normally clubs budget for somewhere between 20-25% of fans attending matches buying programmes. So the only way you can effectively order a program these days would have to be ordering online. And I think a lot of fans would choose not to do that. I mean, clearly we've got program collectors. We also have huge clubs such as Manchester United who have global followings, and they sell huge numbers of programs overseas because clearly their fans, it's a way of engaging. I think they would still do quite well. But for the smaller clubs, we've got to include our clubs there. Then I think there would have been a substantial reduction. And when do you read the programme? You read it at the ground or half time, and that's when the advertising, in theory, sort of embeds itself in your subconscious. But it won't be the same from an online programmes which some clubs are offering. You don't even notice the advertising. I think it will have impacted upon clubs in negative revenues.
Okay. Does anyone actually read the program? I mean, you may be on away journeys coming home from a game when the train's broken down, possibly. But it's a shame actually, because most match day programs are really, really good now, really interesting compared to the four sheets of tissue thin paper. I was going to say paper thin paper then, Kieran, but that would be another indication of how early in the morning it is. Oh, this paper is so thin. I don't think there was some way to describe how thin this paper was. Toby Gray, it's not first thing in the morning for you, Kieran, is it? You've been up and about doing all sorts for hours, I imagine. Toby Gray says, in the Premier League, all clubs receive, I believe, roughly £1 million every time they're selected for television. However, with all games currently on television, are they getting more money?
No, they're not. This is something I did have to dig into. The Premier League actually sell 7 packages domestically to the broadcasters. And those 7 packages cover 200 out of the 380 matches. And what happens is that you end up with first, second, third, fourth, you know, picks, yeah, and so on. And the document itself, the proposal document, is very detailed, very complex. But broadly, what happened in terms of the deal that we're presently in is that Sky and BT are paying around about £9.3 million a match. Let's ignore any rebates. And that's for a fixed number of matches. So Sky get the, I think pick number one is 4 o'clock on a Sunday. And then pick number two, I think, is 2 o'clock on a Sunday and things of this nature. So that's all detailed in a very complex formula. And if you appear on television, if you are picked within those 200 matches more than 10 times a year, you are entitled to an extra £1 million per appearance in what we refer to as a facility fee. Mm-hmm. Now, in respect of the additional matches which are being shown live on the BBC, Sky, and so on, those matches are effectively being given to the broadcasters for free by the Premier League as part of the sort of, please don't ask for a bigger rebate.
Right, okay.
So I think the way that it will work in terms of facility fees is, we are recording this on the Sunday.
First thing Sunday morning, Kieran.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Kevin.
It's not even 10 o'clock. If the European Super League kicks off again today, Kieran, we're in big trouble. You know that.
I've been working on this since 5 this morning.
I'm sorry.
I am in so much trouble.
Well, let's crack on, Kieran. Let's not discuss how much trouble you're in because that would take longer.
So they're not getting extra money, but the facility fees are still being paid by Sky via the Premier League because Sky say, well, today's match, the key match is Manchester United versus Leeds, and therefore we've still got our first pick rights. So the matches which are on the weird times, so let's take, under normal circumstances, there would not be a match at 8 o'clock on a Saturday evening. The chances are that is going to be an 8th, 9th or 10th pick because it's Sheffield United versus Brighton and it was 90 minutes of utter shite.
I'm afraid I did occasionally flick onto something that Vernon Kay was presenting that I work in television and I struggled to work out what it was. But it wasn't Sheffield United and Brighton aimlessly kicking a ball about. Let's move on, Kieran. Neil Kimpton has asked an interesting question. I always worry about saying that in case people think I'm implying that their question wasn't interesting. If your question is interesting, everybody, this is why we ask them. And those people whose questions we haven't asked yet, your question is interesting as well, but we've got a long waiting list. But Neil Kimpton says, why are there no sponsors on the front of national team shirts? Is there a FIFA UEFA ruling on it? Is it just not the done thing? The Soviet Union used to have CCCP on the front of their shirts. Did they get permission for that? Neil, let's not get Kieran on to reminiscing about the front of Russian shirts just at the moment. CCCP was a Cyrillic abbreviation for the USSR, basically. But it's a good point, Kieran. I would hate it, but presumably rugby fans don't mind because they're happily emblazoning logos on the front of their shirts, aren't they?
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yes, they are. This is all to do with UEFA and FIFA having individual partners in individual industries. And what they don't want is for the exclusivity that FIFA have. So FIFA have global partners for their World Cup competition, such as Adidas, Coca-Cola, Visa, Budweiser, McDonald's. Now, McDonald's would be really cheesed off if, let's say, that Ghana are sponsored by Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yeah.
So that would be seen to be a rivalry for McDonald's, or you know, MasterCard support the German shirts. So this actually is used by FIFA to generate more money for itself, but clearly that also results in less money for the individual football associations, because you know the England or the Brazil, the Germany, you know, US shirts, they would be worth a fortune in terms of advertisers, especially in a World Cup year. So this is FIFA flexing its muscles, and it's the same for UEFA. And remember, if you think about the number of international matches that take place, UEFA have the rights for the qualifying competitions, and FIFA have the rights for the qualifying competitions as well as the finals. So it doesn't really leave very much else. So if England, in theory, could, I suspect, have a shirt sponsor for friendlies, but it would just look a bit naff. And you know, the manufacturers, Nike, I think they wouldn't be over pleased. You know, we used to see England in training kit with Nationwide on it, for example. So it's only for the match day shirts that this particular veto applies.
Do you know, I'll be perfectly honest, Kieran. I don't like to see players' names on international shirts. They don't belong to the player. The number belongs to the country is an old fashioned view I've always taken. So are you implying then, Kieran, that rugby doesn't have enough international backers to worry about upsetting them with individual sponsors? Because
I think you know, if we take a look at the Five Nations tournament, you know, that's effectively just split between the five countries. And whilst there is the International Rugby Football Union, the Rugby Union World Cup is you know, a relatively recent phenomenon, and the power share is actually with the individual rugby unions as opposed to the global organization. We all know that FIFA is a very political, you know, mafia style body, you know, and I can say that without fear of any reactions, because you've just got to look at the number of people that have been prosecuted for inappropriate behavior who have been, you know, senior people there. So whereas the IFRU and, you know, from a rugby league perspective and other sports, it tends to be the power lies at a slightly lower level.
Now, on a similar note, Toby Bowles has pointed out something that I think a lot of football fans have wondered when they watch Newcastle games. Toby Bowles says, why doesn't Mike Ashley choose to advertise his Sports Direct company on Newcastle shirts? Is it because of a potential backlash from fans? And which club owners, if any, do advertise their company on the team shirt? Can I answer this, Kieran, please?
Yeah. Go for it.
Is it because Mike Ashley gets more money from somebody else than he would do if he sponsored his own shirts?
Well, I think that's a potential contributory factor, absolutely.
that's good teaching, Kieran. You didn't tell me it was wrong. You said potentially. That's an interesting, yeah. Okay.
People might recall that St James's Park was once called the Sports Direct Arena.
Indeed, yes. But not by Newcastle fans, I hasten to add.
And such was the backlash that I think Mike Ashley is taking to a certain extent the once bitten twice shy approach here. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it makes sense to get external money into the club, as opposed to him funding it. Sports Direct also have extensive advertising on billboards, and we now have these big banners, don't we? On that stadium. So the perception of Sports Direct in Newcastle is somewhat tainted through its association with Mike Ashley, and don't grab a tiger by the tail is my view. The sales of Newcastle shirts in a city which is football mad are actually lower than you would expect, and part of this is just that they don't want to have anything to do with bringing more money into Mike Ashley. We saw the Blackpool fans with their Not a Penny More campaign, which helped to contribute to the former convicted rapist Owen Oyston leaving the club. And I think some Newcastle fans say, right, we're not going to buy a shirt until Ashley leaves, because yes, we want to see our team. You're in love with the club, but why give additional money, which is simply going to go through to Mike Ashley's coffers? So there has been a backlash in terms of the extent of merchandise sales are probably lower than you'd anticipate. And if they had Sports Direct on the front, the sales of kits would be even lower than they are at present.
And the second part of Toby's question is, do we know any owners who do advertise their company on their team shirts?
Yes. One of the Price of Football's all-time heroes, Andy Holt at Accrington. Wham sponsor the shirts there. Clearly, we've got the Etihad at Manchester City. It's not directly, but it's pretty close to the owners. And Leicester City, for many years, of course, were sponsored by King Power.
Of course, yes. Okay, thank you, Toby. Lee Taylor says that a few clubs over the past few years have been selling grounds to their owners or other companies, including mine, Aston Villa, and them lot down the road, who I assume here in our Birmingham City, because Lee has just written the B and the Y, and the rest is asterisks. Good work, Lee. And Lee says, recently our not-so-friendly neighbours from the other side of the A38 expressway have had a problem with their ground and have partly shut it. So who would pay for these repairs? Would it be the club as tenants or the owners of the ground? Now, my mother-in-law lives in Birmingham. I go there often, or I used to, and I love it. But only in Birmingham would someone make that question so geographically explicit. Only in Birmingham would they have to say, well, of course, it's the A38 expressway. They're on the other side. It's like, yeah, fine. So, Hallie's mother-in-law's next door neighbour. So it doesn't matter which stations the train went through, does it? It just went through the same stations as it always went through. They're obsessed with geography in that city. But it's an interesting question, though. If you do sell the ground, who are responsible for repairs?
Well, it will vary tenancy agreement to tenancy agreement. If we look to see what we have at West Ham in respect of the London Stadium, they are responsible for relatively little for the £3 million a year that they get for the 62, is it going up to 64,000 capacity stadium. To a large extent, it tends to be irrelevant, because if we take a look at some of the recent stadium sales, Aston Villa, Birmingham, Reading, Derby, Sheffield Wednesday, and now Scunthorpe, given that they are owned by the same person, ultimately it's coming out of the same person's pocket. So it could be if I was being creative with the accounts, Kevin, and I was trying to avoid financial fair play, and perish the thought I'd ever think about this, and I happened to be thinking about it, I would make sure that the landlord is responsible for the repairs and changes, because that's one less cost to go through into my FFP calculations. But I'm sure that's never entered the thought processes of owners who have been selling their stadiums to themselves at very, very generous prices. So that's where we are. Okay. But the world of stadiums is weird. We had Walsall's stadium, which was sold to a company which appeared to be linked to the pension fund of the club owner, and Walsall were paying rent on it. So soon as you start to dive deeper and deeper into this, there's a whole chapter to be written in somebody's book about this particular relationship.
We should write a book, Kieran, shouldn't we? the lawyers would have a field day with our book, wouldn't they? Now, our next question, Kieran, comes from a chap called Gordon Brown, ex-Prime Minister and Chancellor of the Exchequer. He wants to know if you're free for another chat later on today. Twice he's called you, Kieran, twice. Gordon Brown's been on the phone in the last couple of days.
Yes. In what has been a fairly surreal week for me, because I started off, and yeah, the reason why I'm in so much trouble is I've done 120 interviews this week. I've still got a full time job teaching.
Yeah, so all of my just stop you there, Kieran. I told my agent on Friday that between us, you and I had done 120 interviews this week. Just to big myself up a little bit. I didn't reveal the bit that you'd done all of them.
So I've got to do my day job, and I do my lecture preparation and all the stuff. You know, I work that in the evenings, or I get up really early. So the reason why I'm in so much trouble at work is that the only way that my wonderful wife, the Baroness, has been able to contact me is by booking me on a Zoom conversation from the kitchen. So it sort of, yeah, things started to calm down on Friday, and she says, we are going to spend this evening together. And I said, I can't see anything else coming through. And what happens, you know, she says, well, what happens if somebody phones you? I said, well, yeah, if it's somebody I know, I'll say no to, and if it's an unknown number, I'll just be polite. And then she sort of said, okay, I'll make it up to you, with a sort of a Carlo Ancelotti style raised eyebrow. And I thought, oh, blimey, it's going to be one of those nights. She might even get out the Russian phrase book if I'm very lucky. So I thought, hey, I'm on a promise here. I just need to keep my nose clean. And it was 8 o'clock and the phone rang, and I didn't recognize the number, and she was just serving up dinner. So I said, I'll just quickly have a word and say, you know, I'm sorry. And I picked up the phone, and it was this, he says, oh, it's Gordon Brown. I thought, I thought, that sounds like Gordon Brown.
Text your lights on, yeah.
So I said, oh, hello, sir. and the Baroness is just staring at me. And you know that look? You know that look when a wife is, and then I'm sort of trying to make signals, going, it's Gordon Brown. And she's going, what? So then he starts talking, and she's just giving me daggers. So I put it on speakerphone, and, you know, it's clear that, you know, Gordon Brown's got a very distinctive voice.
Indeed.
So the Baroness curtsies at a telephone. And I'm trying to have this conversation. No, he can't see you. He can't see you. And so, yeah, for some reason, somebody had given Gordon Brown was talking on Football Focus, but he's also he's been involved with the likes of David Bernstein and Gary Neville and so on, with a view to coming up with something to deal with, you know, football governance and finance. And an owner of a football club had said, there's this somewhat nerdy guy who knows every single number going. But Swiss Ramble wasn't available. So therefore I was second in line. I think the Swiss was at a yodeling competition in the evening. I don't know what the hell was going on. So I'm having this conversation. So I started off by calling him sir. And then I moved on to Mr. Brown, and he was on for an hour. And you know, I could tell he was taking notes, very, very detailed, certainly knew his stuff. Yeah. And by the end of the conversation, it was Big G. You know, we were buddies. We were besties. I'm just a simple lad from the land of the bogs and the little people. And, you know, why is this conversation taking place? He took down notes, and, you know, some of the stuff which we've discussed on the show in terms of, you know, why are gambling companies getting a free pass in terms of football? Okay.
Right.
So he took that on board, and he mentioned that on Football Focus. We've also spoken about fans being able to have some form of representation on the board, even if we don't move to 50+1. So, you know, and some of these have already, of course, been discussed. He's spoken to, you know, David Dean, Bernstein, Gary Neville, and so on. But he was very receptive. I do have a few numbers I was able to help him with. And then he phoned up again on Saturday morning. It was very good, you know. And, you know, we've had, you know, Conservative Party MPs on the show. We've had Andy Burnham, the Langham. We tried to have a broad church, because football belongs to the people and not just the people of one political party. But yeah, it was weird. I mean, I'd started off the morning on Pakistan TV at some ridiculous hour, because of course they're about 6 or 7 hours behind us, and then finished off the evening with former Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown. What a day!
I'm very proud of you, Kieran. I'm generally very proud of you. It's a real feather in your cap. But it also, the second time he phoned, reminded me of my favourite showbiz story, Kieran, which an engineer at Elstree Studios told me about his granddad. Burt Lancaster came over to make a film at Elstree in the late 50s, and Burt Lancaster was a man who didn't approve of what he called effete actors, so he liked to make friends with the crew, and he liked to find a local pub. And he befriended his granddad, Ted. And it led to this scenario whereby the doorbell rang at his granddad, Ted's house, and his gran opened the door, and she shouted up the stairs, "Ted, it's that bloody Burt Lancaster again." But Gordon Brown's phoned him again. And of course, Matt Ali did a lot of work around the Drop the Deck campaign back in Jubilee 2000, and Gordon Brown was a huge supporter of that. So she was very, very full. I'll just imagine the look on the Baroness's face when dinner's going cold. "It's Gordon Brown, darling. What can I do? Who gave him my number?" Anyway, Mark Cartwright. I am very proud of you, Kieran. That's brilliant. Well done. Mark Cartwright has a question. A nice accountancy question, Kieran, perhaps as a sorbet after that shocking showbiz interlude we just had. Mark Cartwright says, when sell-on clauses are invoked, are they only applicable when the player is sold for a greater price than what they were bought for? Now, this is a good question, Kieran. It's never occurred to me to ask this. And Mark Cartwright says, so if, for example, you buy a player for $10 million but sell for $5 million, do you still have to pay a 10% sell-on fee? As apparently, says Mark, Wren sold Rafinha to Leeds at a reduced cost to avoid a large sell-on fee to Sporting Lisbon.
Okay. My understanding is that the sell-on is in relation to the profit on the deal.
Ah, okay.
So if you spend £40 million, buy a turkey, and you sell him for £10 million with a 10% sell-on, at least you keep all the £10 million. As opposed to having to then give, you know, 10-15% of it to somebody else. There's nothing in theory to stop a club putting in a clause, but I can't see anybody ever accepting it. The problem with sell-on clauses is it does. I mean, as Mark sort of, Mark's suggesting, will some clubs try to circumvent the rules? And yes, they will. The best way to do that is if you've got a player who you're selling with a large sell-on clause, don't sell him directly, have a player swap.
Right.
Because what you can let's say that you've got a player that you signed for £10 million. Now, you know, I'll use the case of Yves Bissouma, Brighton's midfielder player, because he's attracting a lot of attention. We bought him £15 million from France. Let's say that they've got a 10% sell-on clause, and his market value at present is around about £50 million. If we sell him for £50 million, then you've got to give 10% of the £35 million profit.
Yeah.
Why not say, well, we're going to do a player swap with player X, and both clubs then say, well, in our opinion, both players are only worth £25 million.
Right.
Therefore, we're going to give you 10% of £10 million. Now, you know, that's a way around it. Clearly, it does require a scenario in which the bidding club has a surplus player who's attractive to the management. So, that's why it can't work every single time. But, you know, I've seen examples of player swaps before, and I thought, Well, I'm pretty certain there was a Flacelle on there, and that's the route that they've taken. What is the value of a football player? It's actually impossible to determine because ultimately we're talking about a unique asset. No two players are the same. So trying to get a definitive determination of price is almost impossible. And also, you get involved in bidding wars. When Coutinho went to Barcelona, I think they originally bid something like £92 million and ended up paying £140 million. Because effectively you're looking at an auction scenario, so it is a complex issue in terms of sell-ons. But this is why FIFA keep documentation to try to prevent these disputes from getting out of hand. Because otherwise, how do you know what is being sold for?
Now, our penultimate question, Kieran, is on a similar-ish note, and it comes from Chris Pope, who says that around 13 years ago, David Nugent, who scored for Tranmere yesterday, David Nugent moved from Preston to Portsmouth for a fee believed to be around £6 million. It was rumoured that payments were staggered, but due to Portsmouth's financial issues, we didn't receive it all. Can you shed any light on that rumour? And, probably more importantly, what happens if a club refuses to or cannot pay any add-ons or future instalments on a transfer?
Right. Well, ultimately here, we are bound by the football creditors rule.
Right.
Where football creditors are players and clubs in respect of outstanding sums. And these have to be paid in full before a club can come out of administration. So David Nugent was signed by Pompey from Preston. The Portsmouth administration and liquidation, and I've been through the documentation this morning as part of doing the background for this. The amount of money that was being taken out by the administrators, liquidators, and lawyers from Portsmouth, even by some of the silver tongued friends we've seen in the past, was quite astounding. But what saved Preston to a certain extent was that Portsmouth had been in the Premier League and they were entitled to parachute payments.
Right.
And when the club went into administration, I think when Portsmouth was still in the Premier League, the Premier League said, if there are any football creditors, what we will do is that we will deduct outstanding sums due from the parachute payments which were due to the club. So I may have got this wrong, I do get things wrong. And I'd also like to apologise to the Manchester United Hong Kong Supporters Club, because when I said, I think on Thursday, we look at international fans, perhaps they're a bit more relaxed about Super League than we are. I got our Hong Kong correspondent, who is absolutely brilliant, happens to be secretary of the Manchester United Hong Kong Supporters Club, we had a poll. We had a poll of our members, and 90% thought this was a crock of horse manure as well.
Yeah.
So it was actually quite comforting to know that it was universal. My understanding is that Preston would have been paid by the Premier League rather than Portsmouth itself in respect of the outstanding instalments. Going on to the second part of Chris's question, if somebody refuses to pay, then it goes to arbitration. And we have seen, and these are the things which sort of fly under the radar. It doesn't tend to be too much of an issue in the Premier League and the EFL, because they do actually police these things pretty well. But there have been instances where there have been international transfers and UEFA and FIFA have imposed sanctions on the club that has not paid the amount involved.
Lovely. Now, our final question comes from Jay. And Jay says, as supporters of the women's game, can you tell me the average amount and percentage the host Premier League men's teams subsidise the women's team for, please? And thank you for that, please, Jay. Are you able to put a figure on that, Kieran?
Well, it really does vary from club to club. We have Chelsea, who are, I think they're in the semi-finals of the Champions League. Fingers crossed for them. We're really, the WSL is coming on. In terms of attractiveness to broadcasters and viewers and so on, at a fast rate, if not so present. Chelsea lost £1.8 million last year, which as a percentage of its income is actually pretty high. It's about 60%, I think. And if you take a look at the accounts of all the WSL clubs, and yeah, that's what we do, Kevin. We look at them all.
We do, between us, in the same way that between us we did 120 interviews and spoke to Gordon Brown this week. We do.
Every one of them lost money apart from one, and that appeared to have a bit of unusual income to reverse the figures. So at present, WSL clubs are losing money. You know, some of them six figures, some of them seven figures. But yeah, we do have the new TV deal, which is coming on stream, which is looking very lucrative. So I think the clubs themselves are hoping that they will be able to reverse those losses and at some point move to more of a break-even model. And I think that'll be good for the women's team because it will help them in terms of their independence, in terms of being dictated to by the other part of the club.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because presumably women's football is working towards that glorious day when they don't need to be subsidised by the men's club, do they? They can financially exist on their own terms.
Yeah. And that'll be good. It's great to watch. I'm looking forward to the Chelsea versus Bayern match. The dog's coming in again.
He likes to announce his ins and outs, doesn't he? What was that toy again?
His wonky chomp.
Has he got his wonky chomp?
Oh yes, he's there. Yeah, because every time the Baroness puts on the on her Nespresso coffee machine, he has a Pavlovian reaction because he associates that with being given a treat. So as soon as you hear that noise in the house, off it goes.
A little insight into life in Sussex for you, there, everybody. I think women's football is going to be one of the big beneficiaries when all this is over. As I'm 100% definitely going to see more Crystal Palace women's matches when this is over, and I think a lot of people will do as well. And I think I've got a feeling, a suspicion, a hope that if anything comes of the fallout from the Super League, it is that many more fans will turn to their local teams and non-league teams and to the women's teams for a taste of a more realistic football, shall we say. Now, thank you to everyone who's become a patron of our pod via our Patreon site, including Neil Baskerville. Hello, Basque. Lucas Gillard, Manuel Bezio, and Ian Thomas, who says thanks for brightening up my Mondays and Thursdays. I know Neil Baskerville, by the way. I wasn't just rudely saying hello, Basque. Neil's a Coventry fan and is a brilliant magician. So if you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to our pod, which would always be three to air, and yes, I am talking to you, Gordon Brown, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have questions on any aspect of football finance that we can answer for you, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And as Kieran simply hasn't got the time this week because he's spending the rest of the day, there's a lot of it left, Kieran.
Yes, there is.
With the Baroness, I will say goodbye and we will see you again on Thursday. Take care, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.